This argument swayed Temeraire to some extent. At least he was persuaded to fly onward without further molesting the bunyips. Later in the evening, Temeraire said thoughtfully, contemplating the stew which Gong Su was brewing, with a meagre haul of kangaroos, "I have never before considered the feelings of a cow. I suppose they must not care for us at all."
"They are only dumb beasts," Lawrence said, "and such thought surely beyond them. Any animal will defend its life and young. But that is not in the same vein as a thinking, reasoning creature."
"Only, how could one be certain?" Temeraire said. "After all, if one wishes to be particularly dull, one might be like that fellow Sulcombe, and say that dragons are also dumb beasts. And I am quite sure the bunyips are not, though they do not seem to talk at all. They are only nasty, thinking creatures. It is not very fair, though, that I should allow them to have sense, because they will contrive one unpleasantness after another. What if cows are very clever, only they do not like to make a fuss about it?"
"If they dislike fuss enough to tolerate being eaten," Lawrence said, with rather an amused expression, "surely it need not matter one way or another."
"Perhaps they think they will be eaten anyway, as they are so delicious," Temeraire said, and sighed. "I would give a great deal for a cow, Lawrence. Not that I wish to complain, and I am very grateful that Gong Su will go to such lengths, only they are a bit thin, the kangaroos, I mean."
They posted a watch that night, and twice Temeraire and Iskierka were obliged to shift their places, as the ground beneath them grew odd and unsteady to a probing stick. Caesar was nearly buried when abruptly a sinkhole opened beneath him, tumbling him down in a cascade of pouring sand. He roused all the camp to his cry of alarm, and several pistol shots were fired uselessly into the dark, spending some of their precious store of munitions for panic.
"Keep your head raised," Rankin said, his hand on Caesar's neck. He had leapt clear as the sand poured in, and then jumped in to keep the young dragon steady. "Fetch a light there, and bring shovels. We will have to clear some of this off him before he can scramble out."
It was near enough 2 hours before he could be resettled, now safe, if uncomfortable, upon an outcropping of rock. They none of them passed a very quiet or a restful night, and in the morning all of Gong Su's stew had leaked away, the consequence of a smaller but equally malicious shifting of the earth beneath the cooking hollow. Temeraire was obliged to eat the gummy and nearly leached clean kangaroo or go hungry, as he had not eaten the night before. They might be soft, but were scarcely palatable. They had all to contend with thirst as well as irritation. Iskierka was all for waging a thorough war upon the enemy. All their shelters were to be fired or filled with smoke, despite the dreadful hazard of open flame in this dry country, and the utter impracticality of fighting who knew how many of the creatures there were, with a force of 4 dragons, 1 half-grown, 1 stunted, and no supply whatsoever. Temeraire at least was growing more willing to be sensible, perhaps under the preoccupying influence of hunger, which drove out some quantity of pride. He said, "I do not like it in the least, but we do not have the time to serve them all out now, and they can make it so very uncomfortable. We had better wait until we have the egg back safely, and then we may settle them. Or," he allowed, "I suppose we may give them a chance to show they can behave better." And that afternoon, when they had taken 6 kangaroos and stopped at another half-dry waterhole, they laid one before the first trap-door which they found and did not molest the covering after all. Iskierka eyed it darkly and brooding. Kulingile eyed it too, with a very different, a yearning expression, but he turned to his own portion instead, and Iskierka grumbled under her breath and did the same. Temeraire was hungry enough to ignore the pain of his throat, and eat the kangaroo unstewed, only roasted a little, and crunching the bones for the marrow, though Lawrence was sorry to see him forced to it, and Temeraire winced as he swallowed.
"It's gone, then?" someone said abruptly.
And Lawrence realized that while they had all been engaged in their own meals, the kangaroo offering had silently vanished. Rather a dreadful reminder of the speed and stealth of their enemies and their omnipresence. But they were at least not harassed the remainder of their halt, although they did not tempt fate. No man ventured anywhere near vegetation, and they drank their share of water under guard. The experiment was repeated that evening, when they paused again at a fresh spring with a larger outcropping of harder, stony ground nearby, where Lawrence thought they might encamp safely. Whether for this reason or the accepted bribe, they did not suffer further attacks that night, and Temeraire declined to risk his supper again and ate his portion of game once more, only seared. They might also by now have been outstripping the speed of the Bunyip's communications, whatever method they used. Tharkay was not particularly sanguine of their chances of finding still more traces of the smuggler's route, and did not encourage the fervent searching for scraps which Temeraire and Iskirka would have indulged in, left to their own devices.
"If they are not going to some central location lying in this direction we have been given, as limited as it may be," Tharkay said, "then we have no hope of catching them. A few shards of 5 years of age and half-buried samples do not make a trail worth following. We may as well hope for a more cooperative fate, and make the only attempt which has a hope of success."
So the dragons flew on with much less investigation of the countryside, and quicker. The red miles were eaten up swiftly with Temeraire's wingbeats, the unvarying dunes rising and falling, vanishing away beneath the leading edge of the black wings, only to be exposed once more, falling behind them like waves receding. The desert might have gone on forever. Everywhere one looked, the world was flat and barren, and strange to the curving, blue-hazed edge of the horizon. Occasional taller hills would swell out of the low dunes, salt pans stretched pallid white, a trickling stream or a hollow full of water. These fell away and rode the earth over the horizon and disappeared, one after another. The shapes were at first easily mistaken for clouds, low on the horizon, but they remained, and grew, and grew, until the brick-red stone was struck by the sunset and glowed fiercely against the sky. They reared up from the flat plateau, enormous and uncanny domes clustering together in the absence of all other company, their surfaces pitted and streaked in grey, a faint clinging fuzz of greenish moss upon a few of their heads. Temeraire slowed as they approached. Lawrence did not know what to think of the peculiar construct. So alone. It was not possible even from the air to encompass the whole. At different angles it had a wholly different appearance, even as that first intensely glowing colour faded, and a twilight cast of violet dampened the dome's presence, blurring them into the sky. Though the stone would have offered a certain refuge from the Bunyips, they did not land upon the rocks. They had from habit and the fatigue of extreme toil begun, Lawrence thought, to grow used to the alien and rust-red landscape. But in their strangeness, the monoliths made all else around them once more strange, a reminder. They encamped instead upon a few dunes not far removed. A little trickle of water came past the camp, not very much to drink from and with no sign of Bunyip management, which they now had little cause to regret. They dug out a hollow in the curve of the creek and it gradually filled. Meanwhile Lawrence stood with Temeraire, watching the strange monumental stones blur and fade away into darkness, as all the stars of the southern hemisphere came wheeling out above.